Hello and welcome to this new season of Sustainable Binghamton Radio. I'm your host, Hadassah Head, and I'm here with another co-host, Jeff.
Hello, my name is Jeff Schmidt.
And our guest, Dick Rayberg.
Hi, I'm Dick Rayberg.
So today we're going to be talking about global climate change, but first let's get a little background for the audience about you.
Sure. I was a member of the faculty here at Binghamton University from 1967 to 2004. I'm a trained sociologist, and I have a real interest in the environment and a passion about climate change, and I lecture publicly on climate change.
Great. At what point did you start getting interested in climate change?
Actually, in 1988, when I taught my first course in environmental policy, and I was aware at that time that our climate was changing, and I began to read intensively in climate change, and I say I probably read at least one book and several papers every week on climate change, or every month.
Wow. All right, so I guess we'll start by asking some basic questions. Some that may even seem kind of funny when first heard, but what is weather?
Well, weather is what we experience on a day-by-day basis, the daily temperature, daily precipitation, daily humidity. Weather is really what occurs in the short term. It could be a day, it could be a week, it could even be a month, but it is certainly not long term.
So then that is different than climate?
Absolutely different from climate. Climate is weather, technical definition, averaged over a period of 30 years. But climate is really weather over very long periods of time, let's say a generation or a century or a millennia or even over millions of years.
All right. So you mentioned 30-year periods. So how exactly is climate change measured?
Well, what we do is over a period of 30 years or 100 years or 1,000 years, we look for trends in temperature, trends in precipitation, how the precipitation falls, whether it falls as rain or falls as snow, changes in barometric pressure, changes in the basic variables that define weather.
Okay. How is the average surface temperature of the Earth calculated, and why might that be important?
Well, when we estimate the surface temperature of the Earth, we use an extraordinarily sophisticated instrument. Every house has one. It's called a thermometer, thermometer. And what we do is we look at temperatures recorded over long periods of time. Now, thermometers have been with us probably for 100 or 200 years, but before that we use approximations such as dating by tree rings, dating by ice cores, but there are other ways to estimate temperature, and those are pretty accurate.
Okay. I'm just very curious about the ice dating, and some you mentioned some that were not so common for the average household to go out and date ice or look at rings. Could you speak a little bit more to that?
Well, one method for doing it is we drill in ice cores, for example, in the Greenland ice core or in Antarctica, and we lift cylinders from those ice cores. Some go back thousands and some go back millions of years, and by looking at different isotopes of oxygen, we can get a good approximation of what the temperature was.
Okay. How does one summarize what happens as energy from the sun begins to pass through the Earth's atmosphere?
That's a very good question. Well, to begin with, a good portion of the sun's energy before it enters our atmosphere is reflected back into space. Then there's a portion of the sun's energy that actually enters the atmosphere. Some of that energy is retained within the Earth's surface itself. And when it is reflected back into space, it is reflected at a longer wavelength, or the infrared wavelength. Some of that passes back to space, but some of it is retained within the Earth's atmosphere, by a blanket of what we call greenhouse gases. If we didn't have those greenhouse gases, the temperature of the Earth would be, let's say, 0 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 60 degrees colder than the average temperature the Earth is today. The interesting question is, why is the Earth, let's say, 60 degrees Fahrenheit on average? The answer to that is because there are certain gases in the atmosphere, particularly carbon dioxide and methane, as well as other trace gases, that have the ability to absorb some of that infrared energy. Think of those gases as a blanket, for example. Now, that blanket has been in the Earth's atmosphere for millions of years. However, what human activity is doing is to increase the thickness of that blanket. It is as though you were sleeping at night and you got cold and you put on an extra blanket. You're going to be warmer. Well, what we are doing through human activities, particularly burning fossil fuels and emitting carbon dioxide, as well as burning tropical forests, and through various activities that emit methane, is over the past 100 to 150 to 200 years, we have increased the thickness of that blanket of greenhouse gases, and we refer to that extra thickness as anthropogenic, or generated by humans. And the more fossil fuels we burn, the thicker becomes the layer of carbon dioxide, as it were, or the greater the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And as a result, the Earth heats up, is warming up, hence the term global warming.
So a lot of people have been talking about global warming in terms of the news. People often say climate change now, global climate change. What is that? What's going on there?
Well, global warming refers only to one, if I may use the technical term, one parameter of climate, which is temperature. And while the temperature of the Earth is indeed increasing, over the past 100 years, the average temperature of the Earth has risen by almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit. When we warm the Earth, we also change other parameters or other factors of the climate. For example, a warmer atmosphere is a more energetic atmosphere. A warmer atmosphere is one that will evaporate more water from the surface, not only of lakes, but the Earth's oceans. Thus, a warmer atmosphere is also an atmosphere with more water vapor. And the more water vapor we have in the atmosphere, the more precipitation we have. In addition, there are also changes in wind velocity and wind direction and in the form of precipitation. So when we talk about climate, we're really talking not only about temperature, but we're talking about the other variables that define climate or define weather.
How has carbon dioxide changed in the atmosphere over some period of time?
Well, if we take, take a period of 100 years, about 100 years ago, carbon dioxide was 280 parts per million in our atmosphere. Today, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide is about 390 parts per million, which I think is an increase of 30 or 40%. On a geological scale, that's almost without precedent. And if we do not take action urgently to reduce carbon dioxide, to reduce human emissions of carbon dioxide, by the end of this century, 2100, we can anticipate that with a carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere will be about 1,000 parts per million. Now, even at the current 390 parts per million, it is higher than it has been in almost any geological time. So by 2100, unless we really curtail our carbon emissions, we'll have 1,000 parts per million, which will almost be without precedent in the 4-billion-year history of the Earth. We are entering uncharted territory with weather patterns and climate patterns that are going to be, shall I say, rather interesting. In fact, we're already beginning to see those. And I offer as an example of that the fact that the Binghamton area within the past 6 years has had two, and I believe they were one in 500-year floods, 2006, which was a record flood, and 2011, which is a record flood. So even if they're one in 100-year floods, but more likely one in 500-year floods, we are now seeing intense weather at a frequency with which, let's say over the past 200 years, we have seldom, if ever, seen it.
So you used the word almost unprecedented. So I hate to be the person that picks at that word. Could you explain a little bit about that? Because there's probably people who have heard about these other examples in history that you may be referring to and said, well, this is proof that this whole global climate change thing is a fraud. So maybe it's important to get it out there and talk about it.
Well, it's important in science to generally be careful in how one makes a statement. Certainly if one goes throughout the weather history of even the Northeast, we'll probably find some place in the past 200 years, 500 years, a flood equivalent to that which we've just had or we had in 2006. That's one of the reasons I use the term almost. Mm-hmm. When we have a system as complex, and I know, Hadassah, that you know a lot about complex systems, when we have a system that is as complex as the weather, there are indeed unknowns and qualifications, but one can state this with a high degree of certainty. A vast majority of the Earth scientists, climate scientists in particular, to be specific, more than 90% of the Earth's climate scientists, believe two things. One, that the Earth climate is changing, and two, that the primary reason for the rather drastic change we're seeing in the Earth climate over the past 100 years is human activities, or what I referred to earlier as anthropogenic. So, A, our climate is changing, it is changing more rapidly, and B, the primary cause of that change is us human beings and the things that we are doing to change the composition of our atmosphere.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned complex systems and systems thinking. We often talk about feedback loops. Is that something, is this a linear relationship? Is this something that we can see, you know, plot along a line? Or is this something more complicated than that?
Well, we certainly can plot it along lines, but if we look at projected temperature increase between now and 2100, for example, temperatures are projected to increase 4 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit. That would not be a linear relationship. That is a curvilinear relationship. And to come back to your earlier question, are there positive feedback loops built into the climate system? Absolutely, yes. Let me give you a superb example of that. If you have been listening to the news, even on the network news, for example, you'll realize that this year, the summer sea ice coverage in the Arctic summer sea ice, is 36% less this year than it has been over the past 30 years. This is the lowest area of coverage of Arctic sea ice in the past 30 years, probably within the past 1,000 years. Now, what does that mean? Well, ice itself has an albedo or reflectivity such that when the energy from the sun reaches the ice, because the ice is white, the ice reflects about 90% of that energy back into space. However, the surface of the sea, being blue-gray, absorbs about 80% of the sun's energy. So the less ice we have, the more open ocean we have. The more open ocean we have, the more the ocean absorbs the energy from the sun. The warmer the ocean becomes, and the warmer the ocean becomes, the more ice it melts. The more ice that melts, the more the ocean warms up, and the more it melts the ice. So we refer to that as a positive feedback loop. On the same plane, 90% of all of the world's glaciers are known to be receding and receding at an accelerating rate. That's one feedback loop. I'll give you a second one with respect to the Arctic. Much of the Arctic landmass is tundra, essentially soil that is more or less frozen permanently. Tundra contains huge amounts, gargantuan amounts, if I may, awesome amounts of carbon dioxide and also methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is about 16 times as potent on a molecule-by-molecule basis as is carbon dioxide. We know that the Arctic tundra is melting.
Methane is something everyone should be familiar with in general.
Yes. primary source of methane is, if I may use the term in the air, flatulence. Okay. Yeah. Interestingly, a major source of methane on the Earth are cows. And it's not the methane that comes out the rear end of the cow that's the primary source from bovine, but it's the methane that they belch out. So you may want to...
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yes. So what is happening in the Arctic as the tundra melts is it is releasing ever larger amounts of carbon dioxide and methane. Hence, the more the tundra melts, the more carbon dioxide and methane it releases. The more carbon dioxide and methane that is stored within the atmosphere, the warmer the temperature becomes, the more rapidly tundra melts. That's a second positive feedback loop. Those loops have rather profound implications for the rate at which climate is changing and for the ultimate temperature of the Earth once we cease emitting greenhouse gases.
And then it gets into the question of how do you categorize the methane and the CO2 from the ice? Is it human caused because we are having an effect on melting the ice, or is it natural because it's coming from the Earth is doing it?
Well, that's a good question. I have never really thought of it in that frame of reference, but let us say this, that there's a very high probability that without any human activity, we would be entering another ice age. So to the degree that our emissions of carbon and methane are warming the Earth and thus melting the tundra and releasing carbon dioxide and methane, that is human-caused or anthropogenic. It would not be happening were it not for the activities of human beings.
Okay. So let's see, is there any more of the kind of basic making sure we get the concepts out to the listeners before we jump to Jeff, who has been writing lots of notes very quickly over here of questions that he's interested in asking?
I think we have a basic understanding of climate change. So we can go to Jeff and see what he has been thinking about, because I've been watching his face very closely, and we'll see what questions he has to ask.
All right. Here's Jeff.
Hello. So some of the questions in conversations that I've gotten about this, what about the sun's output? Do we know that the sun is responsible for this? Do we monitor the sun?
Very good question. There are some climate change skeptics today who argue that to the degree that the Earth's climate is changing, not all of the skeptics agree that, but to the degree that it is changing, it is because of sunspot activity. Sunspots generally have a cycle of about every 11 years. We are now currently entering the beginning of an increase in sunspot activity. However,
can you explain what a sunspot is?
Yes, a sunspot is a storm on the surface of the sun. If you look at it through a carefully shielded telescope, because you never want to look directly at the sun, you can actually see them on the sun, and they do look like huge thunderstorms, as it were. We do monitor the sun very carefully. Before satellites, we monitored them through telescopes, the sun through telescopes. Now that we have satellites, we monitor sunspot activity both through telescopes on Earth and through satellites in the atmosphere. And we know that over the past 100 or 200 years, the output of the sun in terms of sunspots has not increased significantly. So you cannot explain a variable, that is to say the increasing temperature of the Earth and climate change, in terms of a constant, which is the sunspot activity on the sun. That has remained relatively constant over the past 100 years while the temperature of the Earth has been changing.
Okay.
That explains that. So these are in no particular order. And you mentioned carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Can you let us know a little bit how we know the carbon dioxide levels, especially back before we have any measurements of that in the atmosphere?
Yeah, carbon dioxide, along with oxygen, is trapped, for example, in ice. It's also trapped in other kinds of rocks. So when we drill deeply into ice cores, we can take that ice and analyze it very carefully, and we can determine what the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere was 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or a million years ago. And we know that the CO2 content of the atmosphere today is, as I mentioned before, higher than at most periods in geological time, and that extends back over millions and millions of years.
Okay. And you mentioned with increase in the temperature of the Earth, the energy in the atmosphere increases, and there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. Can you explain a little bit how some areas would be expected to have a water shortage in that type of scenario?
Yes. One of the things about climate change is areas that are dry tend to be drier. Areas that are wet tend to be wetter. And that has to do with changes in the ocean's temperature and currents in the ocean and how that affects atmospheric currents. For example, the equator, let's say plus or minus a number of degrees, that area generally is becoming drier. If you look in North Africa, Somalia, for example, you'll find that over the past 30 or 40 years, they have had periods of very long droughts. If you look at the United States, Texas, for example, is now in a record-breaking drought. So the areas around the equator, plus or minus maybe 100 or 200 or several hundred miles, are becoming drier. Areas such as the northeastern United States are becoming wetter. That is a normal part of the consequences we anticipate from climate change.
Okay, and now you mentioned an ice age. Can you explain how a warming climate could turn into an ice age?
Yeah. Yes. In the Atlantic Ocean is the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream carries very warm water from the Gulf of Mexico up the East Coast, along the Canadian coast, just south of Iceland, and then it heads eastward, for example, to England. If you actually look at a map, you'll find that England is substantially north of the United States, but as we know, the temperatures in England are much more moderate.
Because it's surrounded by water, right?
Well, it's surrounded by water, but also because it is warmed by the Gulf Stream. Now, what may well happen, and there's precedent for this about 10 or 12,000 years ago, what may well happen is that as the salinity and temperature of the Atlantic Ocean changes, the Gulf Stream will, so to speak, either slow considerably, there's evidence that is already happening, or there is a slight possibility that the Gulf Stream might shut down entirely. If the Gulf Stream were to shut down entirely, that means that the warm waters would no longer move into the Arctic, and as a consequence of that, the Arctic is much likely to get colder, and we could have a paradox of most of the world, which is warmer, and yet the east coast of the United States, Greenland, Labrador, and some parts of Western Europe would be significantly colder than they are today.
So it would be more like a yin-yang world, right? Extremes.
If one would not want to use that Chinese expression, yes, one could say that.
Yeah.
Some of the people that talk about climate change say, "So what? What does this mean for me or us?"
That's a good question. Maybe the three of us should go out today and go to Owego, New York, or we could go to Texas, Rick Perry's state. Which is, in a sense, literally burning, record drought, record high temperatures. And we could ask people in Owego, people here in Binghamton, people in Texas, is the weather different? So what? What difference does it make to you? We know the difference that it has made here in Broome County. I am not, and I really wish to emphasize, I'm not saying that the flood of 2011 is a direct cause of climate change. Flood of 2006, flood of 2011, those are weather events. And by definition, weather is short-term. But everything we know about climate change means that the probability of these severe weather events occurring increases and increases significantly, if not dramatically. So if one were to ask, is it probable that the flood of 2006, the flood of 2011, is at least in part a function of climate change? The answer to that is yes. Is it probable that the weird winter we had last winter is a function of climate change? The answer to that is yes. I have seen one projection on the Weather Channel that this winter we may have a repeat of last winter. And in part, that's a function of a very high pressure area, which is now anchors itself during the wintertime over Greenland and steers the jet stream deeply into the United States. We could have another harsh winter despite the fact that unequivocally the Earth itself is warming.
And I have just one last question. Is the Earth able to naturally handle such changes in climate and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? Does it, you know, are there more trees in certain areas? Does it try to absorb more? How does that work?
Yes, we see already an activity increase in some kinds of photosynthetic activity. Let me use Jeff's question simply to say, the Earth will survive any kind of climate change. That's a given. There's no question about that. The question is, will we human beings, and will other species survive climate change? The answer for other species, well, already we know that 15 to 45% of all species are already threatened by climate change. The probability is that if we do not do something urgently to reduce our emissions of carbon, we're going to live in a climate world in 2100 which is unlike that which we have ever known. It is possible it will change how humans exist on this planet in a dramatic and potentially catastrophic way.
So, after our dramatic conclusion of the interview, the more the factual part of the show, how can people get involved or learn more, especially about what's going on here in Binghamton?
Very good place to start would be this Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, 183 Riverside Drive, just west of Lord's Hospital. The Unitarian Universalist Congregation Green Association is sponsoring an eco-forum, and our featured speaker is Amelia LaRoche, who is Sustainability Director for the City of Binghamton. She will be presenting a PowerPoint of the City of Binghamton's Climate Action Program. And that consists of a greenhouse gas inventory for the City of Binghamton, as well as suggested measures for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in transportation, commercial and residential buildings, and other ways. That's this Sunday, Unitarian Universalist Congregation, 183 Riverside Drive, 12:45 to 1:45 p.m. in the Fireside Room, and there's ample parking to the rear.
Great. Thank you.